This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the UN Refugee Agency steps up efforts to handle the mass influx of people in Europe. Israeli-Palestinian tensions heat up. The goal of perfection is far from perfect.
With perfectionism, our whole identity gets tied up in our efforts, our appearance, our relationships, and then we try to control things that we don't always have a lot of control over.
A Voice of America jazz legend lives again. These stories and more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. European interior ministers failed Monday to agree on a plan to relocate 120,000 migrants across the European Union. While a majority of the ministers support the plan for binding quotas, many of the objections came from Eastern European nations, including Hungary and Slovakia. Their borders are among the first stops for migrants trying to get to Western Europe. The ministers did agree on an earlier plan to relocate 40,000 migrants now in Greece and Italy. Jana Mason is the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Senior Advisor for External Affairs. She spoke with International Edition's Jeffrey Young about the size and extent of the UN Refugee Agency's efforts to address the needs of tens of thousands arriving in Europe.
My organization, the UN Refugee Agency, is indeed on the ground in Europe. We're at the Hungarian-Serbian border. We're in Greece, Macedonia, Serbia, elsewhere. Our primary objective is to assist those governments in responding to the situation, both in terms of emergency supplies like tents, plastic sheeting, thermal blankets, helping those governments receive these refugees and others who are streaming across their borders, helping them respond in terms of registration, and ultimately giving technical assistance and guidance so that these governments can hopefully relocate these individuals in an equitable manner around Europe, around the various countries in Europe.
So does the UN Refugee Agency have both the resources and the money to fully address this refugee crisis? And if not, then what's needed?
This is a situation that, even though it is indeed a crisis right now, it is large numbers, it doesn't have to be unmanageable if both European governments and the international community as a whole, both the United States, other Western governments and countries in the region, if they all do their part. And it should be noted that the primary response to the Syrian refugee crisis is not being addressed in Europe. It is being addressed in the countries bordering Syria, Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan, Iraq, Egypt, and elsewhere, bordering countries, and then others in the Syria region, where over 4 million Syrian refugees are currently living and receiving assistance. And my agency and non-governmental organizations and other UN agencies have been working for the 4-plus years of the Syrian refugee crisis to provide aid in the region. Part of what we're seeing in Europe is because funding is just not, unfortunately, keeping up with the needs. People in those countries, even though they are protected from harm, are getting increasingly desperate in terms of assistance and what kind of future they may have. That's why they're pouring into Europe at this time.
The annual fall UN General Assembly session is coming up. What can the UN in that session do to get member countries to step up to the plate and take some of the refugee burden and also pony up some money?
U.S. government and others that have the financial means to provide assistance in the region, and that's a big part of it. Other countries like the U.S., Australia, the U.K. can provide resettlement. And in Europe, where what they're getting is spontaneous arrivals of asylum seekers, we need a comprehensive European response so that if they divide up these individuals around the countries in Europe, it won't be overwhelming for any one country. So a comprehensive response, funding in the region, resettlement offers, and ultimately, we need diplomatic efforts to solve the crisis in Syria.
That was Jana Mason, the UN Refugee Agency's Senior Advisor for External Affairs, talking with International Edition's Jeffrey Young. As Europe continues to bicker over sheltering the tens of thousands of refugees, public opinion in France is changing in favor of the Iraqis and Syrians who are arriving. France is promising to take in more than 24,000 refugees over the next 2 years. Lisa Bryant reports from the Paris suburb of Cergy-Pontoise, where a recreation center opened its doors to the first arrivals from Germany.
The end of a long nightmare. For these Iraqis and Syrians, the perilous journey by foot, boat, train, and bus winds up at this recreation center, at least for now. Hundreds are being bused from Germany, which is grappling with a record influx of asylum seekers.
Bon, ils arrivent, ils sont fatigués, donc la première chose c'est de manger, boire.
Recreation center head Sylvain Desmet says the refugees arrive exhausted. They're fed and meet with officials from different government services who also check to see if they need medical or psychological care. Omar Abdulmunam fled his home in the heavily bombarded Damascus suburb of Douma 25 days ago.
I saw the child die and blood everywhere and destroy everywhere. It's so horrible things. And I escaped from Douma to Damascus and from Damascus to Lebanon, Turkey, Europe, Macedonia, Serbia, Hungary, Germany, here.
Ali Tarabien also came from the Damascus area. Like everybody here, he arrived by overnight bus from Germany.
To be honest, I decided to stay in Germany, but I see the French people there. I talk with them around maybe 4 hours. They promise it's like Germany and maybe better for me because I want to bring my family.
Like elsewhere in Europe, the French are divided over the flood of asylum seekers. People here are bringing clothes and toys for the refugees. They'll be moving to more permanent housing in a few weeks, including in French homes. But the far right oppose more newcomers, and conservative politicians want limits. Two French mayors say they will only take in Christian refugees, not Muslims. A new poll indicates French public support has swung in favor of taking in more refugees compared to just 1 week ago. Many here hope the welcome will last. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Sergi Pontoise, France.
In a previously unannounced move, British Prime Minister David Cameron met Monday in Lebanon with some of the Syrian refugees who will resettle in Britain. Britain is accepting up to 20,000 refugees over the next 5 years. And now we turn to reaction on Twitter about the refugee crisis in Europe. International Edition's G. Abby Lee is here with the latest.
Hi, Ray. I'm closely following tweets from our own Aisha Tanzim. As you know, she has been tweeting photos and updates from the Hungarian border. You can find her on Twitter at atanzim, that's A-T-A-N-Z-E-E-M. You can also search for other tweets from VOA reporters on location by using the hashtag VOAAlert. Aisha's latest tweet reads like this: sleepy children in Roskilde after midnight to get on the train to the Austrian border. She also wrote an article that explained how language barriers are adding to the refugee struggles in Europe. Most of them speak Arabic or Pashto, and the number of the interpreters who can help them seem to be seriously lacking.
I see. This is certainly a situation involving lots of people and lots of languages. What about the UN High Commissioner for Refugees? Is the UNHCR tweeting anything about the issue?
Oh, absolutely. The UN Refugee Agency at Refugees on Twitter has been tweeting and retweeting a lot on the situation in Hungary. One tweet that's getting a lot of attention is a picture of a baby born on the road. The baby's parents are Syrian refugees, and that photo has been retweeted more than 140 times. Ray, one of the most shared tweets on the refugee crisis is by President of the EU Commission, Jean-Claude Juncker. Juncker tweeted Sunday night that he spoke with German Chancellor Angela Merkel, and the two leaders agreed to keep the EU borders open and to pursue solidarity in managing refugee crisis. That tweet has been shared more than 600 times. He's on Twitter at JunckerEU, that's JunckerEU. Ray?
Thanks, G. Social media reporter G. Abby Lee, and you can follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. That's spelled J-E-E-A-B-B-E-Y-L-E-E. And this is VOA.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artist. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called emergency talks with his ministers on Monday to discuss the surge in violence between Israelis and Palestinians in Jerusalem. A Jewish man died Monday when his car crashed into a ditch after it was struck by a Palestinian rock thrower. Two others in the car were hurt. Palestinian protesters and police fought for the second straight day outside a religious site in East Jerusalem, revered by both Muslims and Jews. Regional analyst Michael Fishbach of Randolph-Macon College in Virginia told International Edition's Victor Beatty tensions have been high since a Palestinian family was killed in a firebombing of two West Bank homes by suspected Jewish settlers back in July.
From the Palestinian side, there's been a considerable amount of rage, particularly among West Bank Palestinians, and that would in the occupied territories, and that would include East Jerusalem, over the deaths, the burning deaths of a family that occurred as a result of an attack by Israeli settlers a number of weeks ago. There was an infant who was burned and killed almost immediately. The father lingered on for about a week or two, and just in the past week, the mother, after lingering in the hospital for a number of weeks, finally died. For Palestinians, emotions and political feelings have been particularly high. And so coinciding with it did, as Jews flock into Jerusalem for the Jewish holidays, it's unfortunately not a surprise that this occurred when it did.
There are some in Israel who want Jews to be allowed to pray there, but apparently now they're not allowed to.
No, since 1967, that's been the case. There are two dimensions to that. The one is that for ultra-religious Jews, it is forbidden to go anywhere on that complex because they believe that somewhere on that complex, which now houses the Al-Aqsa Mosque, as well as a shrine, a very beautiful shrine known as the Dome of the Rock, that somewhere in that esplanade is where the Hebrew Temple stood 2,000 years ago, and somewhere within that temple complex is where the Holy of Holies stood, which is where the actual presence of God was. So for religious Jews, it is forbidden to go up there because you might accidentally step on the Holy of Holies. On the other hand, you have the Israeli government trying to limit political problems over Jews trying to pray there because there's great fear among Muslim Palestinians that someday they intend to demolish those shrines and mosques and rebuild the Jewish temple.
Professor Michael Fishbach of Randolph-Macon College in Virginia also says without some incentive for both sides to reach a deal, an agreement will likely remain elusive. He was speaking with International Edition's Victor Beatty. OPEC says the world will be wanting more of its oil next year as prices continue to drop and gasoline prices slide downward. International Edition's Jim Stevenson spoke with business correspondent Alexis Christophers in New York about what effect lower prices could have on buying and creating demand.
The oil cartel is sticking to its view that a strategy of letting prices fall will tame the U.S. shale boom and cut a global surplus. The monthly report from the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries also said a weaker outlook for China would contribute to slower global oil demand growth next year. So OPEC is predicting that non-OPEC output will slump by 110,000 barrels a day next year. Remember last week, the International Energy Agency forecast an even steeper plunge of 500,000 barrels a day by 2016. So as it becomes clear the OPEC countries are not going to cut production to ease the oversupply of oil, U.S. shale producers have begun to scale back. And we saw the West Texas Intermediate contract settle at $44 a barrel, down 63 cents on the day. It's above the six-year low of about $39 a barrel we saw last month, but it is still well below the $60 level producers had hoped for in the second half of the year. Also, we've got that plunge in gas prices, down about 30 cents a gallon in the U.S. alone in just the past week, and more worries about demand from China, also pressuring oil prices. China's factory output grew by 6.1% in August, a disappointing number that cast doubt on the strength of its industrial activity. Jim?
While some things are perhaps weakening, Apple says that the sales of its new iPhone are off to a strong start. How are they doing?
Yeah, appears to be gangbusters. The recently announced iPhone 6S and 6S Plus is approaching another sales record for Apple. Pre-orders were made available September 12th, and the tech giant says customer reaction has been, quote, extremely positive. Apple says the company is on pace to beat last year's 10 million unit first weekend record when the new iPhones go on sale September 25th, and the shipment wait time is already as long as 4 weeks. An analyst at Piper Jaffray predicts Apple will sell 12 to 13 million iPhones during its launch weekend. And analysts say China is playing a big role in the strong start for iPhone pre-orders. They point to room for growth with Apple's 15% market share in the region and, of course, rising demand for the App Store.
Business correspondent Alexis Christopherson in New York, speaking with International Edition's Jim Stevenson. Coming up, perfect is far from perfect. This is VOA.
This is Greenbee for a healthier planet.
It's a simple idea, really.
So you bring your food to the boil on a normal fire, and then you take the food off the fire, put it into the bag, and it continues to cook for 8 to 12 hours.
Sarah Collins is the founder of Wonderbag, a cooking system that she says cuts down on harmful fumes from open fires and makes the job of cooking a lot easier, with less wood to collect and haul home. But Collins says Wonderbag provides more than just a way to cook.
What we're seeing is huge changes in the economic status and the business acumen of women who are selling Wonderbags, also saving time and being able to sell other things.
Since it cuts down on electricity use, Collins says the Wonderbag has gained attention across the globe, even in the West, where you can find it for sale on the Internet. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Green Beat.
This is VOA's International Edition. Being a perfectionist is not always a good thing. You might get everything just right, just the way you want it, but is that always a good thing? Dr. Jane Bluestein wrote a new book about it called The Perfection Deception, and she spoke with International Edition's Susan Yockey.
What we're looking for is really the pursuit of excellence, you know, really trying to do our best. The downside is, with perfectionism, our whole identity gets tied up in our efforts, our appearance, our relationships, and then we try to control things that we don't always have a lot of control over. So if I can only be worthwhile in my mind, if I have this belief that I'm only lovable and safe and worthwhile if I'm not making mistakes, I'm either likely to not try something, I'm likely to give up if I don't succeed the first time, which, you know, quite frankly, most of us don't when we're doing something new, or if I'm with somebody who, you know, maybe doesn't have his shirt tucked in right or doesn't look the way I think she should look or whatever, it really can ruin your life because it takes all the joy out of pursuing new experiences, and it certainly is a real downer in a relationship.
Well, is perfectionism something you have or you don't? Can you stop being a perfectionist if you are already?
Well, you know, that's a great question, because I can be really perfectionistic about certain things and really not care about others. So it's not like a switch that's on and off. And in fact, I've worked through an awful lot of my perfectionistic issues. But boy, writing this book brought a lot of them back up. So it's like a constant project. And I don't know that there's an off switch. You know, I started the fourth section which is about really healing and kind of not letting perfectionism run our lives, with my wish that I had a cure for it. What I have found in 2 years of interviewing hundreds of people who've wrestled with this issue is more that they have found ways to, you know, to manage the impact that it had, the negative impact, of course, that it has on their lives.
Well, how is the media contributing to the rise in perfectionism in people?
Well, the media is certainly, you know, would be very easy to blame for it all, but it's only one factor. And part of the, you know, the barrage of images that we're constantly getting about how we should look, how our home should look, what kind of car we're going to drive, and if we just do this, we'll be happy. If we can, you know, just go on this diet, or if we can just get this degree or whatever. And there's always this promise that something, if we can just manage to get our own bodies into this size, shape, career, or whatever, that we'll be happy. There's always this payoff promised at the end. And so we look at people in ads, especially print ads, where, you know, they've all been airbrushed and photoshopped and stretched, where they don't even look like the people in them anymore. And we think, oh, that's what I'm supposed to look like. And how many people, men and women, are starving themselves or doing surgery or doing, you know, really harmful things to their bodies, thinking that they will be more lovable and acceptable if they just look like this person who doesn't even look like who they really are.
Dr. Jane Bluestein, author of the new book called The Perfection Deception, speaking with International Edition's Susan Yockey. The late Willis Conover brought jazz and popular music to the world over our airwaves at VOA for more than 40 years. Now a new archive of some of his recorded programs is being made available to the public through the University of North Texas Library. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with Maristela Fustil of North Texas about the archive and its significance in the history of jazz.
First of all, how did you come to know Willis Conover, and how did the University of North Texas start to store his programs?
Well, the collection was transferred quite a bit before my time. That transfer was made in 1997 through the Willis Conover Jazz Preservation Foundation, which was headed by Leonard Garment. And I arrived as a student at North Texas for the jazz guitar program in 2005 and started working in the music library in 2007 because it was a summer job that was quiet and air-conditioned. I quickly fell in love with library work, and that summer would have been the first time I asked somebody, who's Willis Conover, and why is his name everywhere in here?
And I understand that the collection has some of Willis's programs that include people like Louis Armstrong and Stan Getz and several other of the giants of jazz, and now it's being digitized from, they were originally recorded on ferrous oxide tape, like reel-to-reel tape, and now it's being put up digitally, and it's being released to the public through the school's library, right?
Yes, the collection includes a treasure trove of interviews with jazz legends. We have Art Tatum in May of 1955. We have hours, I believe, of Louis Armstrong. We have Dave Brubeck, Kai Vinding, George Avakian. Those are among the early releases. And this came about from the almost 2,100 reels in the Conover collection through a Grammy Foundation grant that we got to digitize the most urgent preservation needs, which are the oldest tapes from about 1955 to 1969. And that's what's made it possible. And we've been able to get the first 10 online with many more to come.
And this is a unique opportunity for people. Many of these artists that Willis spoke with have passed on. And so this is a unique opportunity to hear them discuss what they do and why they did it the way they did, right?
Yes, it's an uncovered chapter in jazz history that we're incredibly excited to be finally making accessible.
There is also an effort afoot to have a stamp made for Willis from the United States Postal Service as someone who was an American pioneer or someone who was a citizen of note, right?
Yes, Willis certainly fits all of the criteria that the Citizen Stamp Advisory Committee states for eligibility to be on a stamp, having had a tremendous cultural and historical impact in so many spheres, both musical, political, you name it. And so we put out an online petition, which wound up getting over 7,000 signatures. And we got a huge help from people such as Doug Ramsey and his Riftides blog in publicizing that this effort was going on.
And where can people go? There's a website where people can go to hear these interviews that Willis did and some of the music that he recorded live. What is that website?
The easiest thing to do is Google UNT Digital Library and then search on the site for Music Library Conover Collection. And that will give you the 10 recordings plus some of the odds and ends of documents that we've scanned over the years to be able to show people just a small sample of what's in the collection.
All right. Well, thank you very much for being with us, Maricela. I appreciate it.
Thanks very much.
That'll do it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news and information on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In late December 2013, Egyptian security forces raided a hotel room that housed the makeshift remote studio of three journalists employed by the Qatar-based Al Jazeera News Network. The three journalists, Australian Peter Grest, Canadian Mohamed Fahmy, and Egyptian Bahar Mohamed, were arrested and charged with airing falsified footage intended to damage Egyptian national security, operating without a license, and supporting ousted President Mohamed Morsi's Muslim Brotherhood, a group considered to be a terrorist organization by the Egyptian government. The three men were tried and found guilty twice. In June of 2014, they were found guilty. Two were sentenced to 7 years imprisonment. One received a 10-year sentence. Citing lack of evidence, an appellate court ordered a retrial. That process began in January 2015. The three were again found guilty and, on August 29th, were sentenced to 3 years in prison. The United States is deeply disappointed and concerned by the verdict handed down by an Egyptian court to the three Al Jazeera journalists, Mohamed Fahmy, Bahir Mohamed, and Peter Grest, said State Department spokesperson John Kirby. The freedom of the press to investigate, report, and comment, even when its perspective is unpopular or disputed, is fundamental to any free society and essential to democratic development. We urge the government of Egypt to take all available measures to redress this verdict, which undermines the very freedom of expression necessary for stability and development. By finding these three men guilty, the government of Egypt has signaled that journalists can and will be prosecuted and imprisoned for simply doing their job of reporting the news. The Committee to Protect Journalists reports that as of July 1, 2015, at least 18 journalists are in prison for their reporting in Egypt. Even one is too many.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
It's 4.